Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Chapter 5. I waited for a minute, then poked my head out the door and looked around the corner. The coast was clear, and there were no people to confront. I stepped outside, closed the door behind me, locked it, put the key in my pocket, and headed into the orange fog. The passageway led to a narrow staircase on the right, about 10 meters away. Going down the staircase was a tricky business, as it felt like it had been made for midgets. I gripped the wooden banister tightly, breathed slowly, concentrated on each step, and navigated the way as it went downward in a semi-spiral. A crowd of people was in the lobby, but no one took notice of me as I passed through and exited onto the street. I stood for a while, breathing in the fresh air, getting my bearings, adjusting my senses to the new world of sounds, sights, and smells on the ground level, then headed off into the labyrinth of the red light district. I walked slowly, keeping my eyes on the ground, watching the slow progression of each step on the cobbled street, engrossed simultaneously in my inner journey and in the outer vortexes of sensation I passed through. Sounds, smells, and brushes of wind and sun on my skin slowed down as I approached each vortex, then sped up again as I broke through into its opposite side, as if I were a piece of sand passing through a succession of hourglasses. Snippets of conversation swirled about my head. "They're in a position now where the government is very reticent about."
"The reason for my success in furniture is..."
"And I went up to this English boy and said, 'You can say him come in Wednesday.' 'That one with the eyes is scary. Looks like he came from the iron works of hell.'" I was unconscious of time passing. The sun, shadows, movements of people, their voices, and the wind prodded me forward until I was standing in front of the Bluebird coffee shop. Rock and roll music was playing inside. It pulled me in like a magnet. I stepped inside the entrance and was greeted by the soft, soothing blues and greens of the wall murals and houseplants. A few people were seated at tables, relaxing. I was past the mushroom peak now, and buzzing pleasantly. I climbed a narrow staircase to the second floor. To my right was a small bar with 5 stools. "I'll have a cup of coffee, please," I said. I reached in my pocket and pulled out a few bills. I didn't have the concentration necessary to figure out what they were worth, so I handed the money to the bartender, who smiled at me, took the necessary amount for the coffee, and handed me back the rest. When my coffee came, I went to the counter across from the bar and sat down next to a man who was reading a Dutch newspaper. In front of me was a large window looking out on the street. I sipped my coffee slowly and watched the movement of passers-by. After a while, intrigued by the paintings on the walls, I got up to take a little tour around the rest of the bar. One painting in particular fascinated me. A large eagle was swooping down on a plant blooming with human fetuses. The eagle's wings were spread widely, its sharp talons stretched out as if to attack, the tip of its beak a glowing crimson. Its eyes bored into my head and held me in a hypnotic trance. "Is this another omen, a messenger sent from the grave to warn me of some calamity? Nah, it can't be. It's got to have something to do with the Black Eagle head shop, Pablo, the magic theater, symbolism, what?" I broke free of its grip and moved on to a corner of the room where a large sofa surrounded a low table that had a tall hookah in the center. I plopped down next to 3 other stone customers, closed my eyes, and sank back into the sofa. The urgent voice of Edwin Starr belting out, "War, huh, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing," jolted through me. "War I despise, 'cause it means destruction of innocent lives." And once again I was tumbling through earlier days, relationships and images of Vietnam War vet buddies with Black Eagle heads on their shoulders spun in my mind. "War has shattered many young men's dreams." "Yes, it has. Yes, it has." And Jesus, there was old Harrison Gant, my buddy of long ago, hovering in there, and now his story unfolded in my mind. Harrison's 3 years older than I. In high school, he's one of the top athletes in the county, not to mention an all-county football, basketball, and baseball player, and active in drama and school politics. Has the lead role in 2 school plays and student body president his senior year. He's hot-tempered and likes to fight.
He ends up drafted into the army after graduating, spends a year in Vietnam, returns to marry his high school sweetheart, and soon has two children. There I am, not long after I return to Arcata from my 1973 European journey, and I join a hippie slow-pitch softball team that Harrison is on. Everyone's afraid of him because he's fought frequently since his return from Nam. It's not really his size that intimidates them. At 6'3 and 190 pounds, he's big, but not overwhelmingly so, but rather his attitude. He's simply not afraid of anything or anyone. When he fights, he won't quit till either he or the other guy can no longer move. What's strange is that at times he's the most compassionate and gentle of men. The sight of children at play is enough to make him cry. At other times he leers at the whole of mankind with a look of such misanthropy, condescension, and evil that you feel he could kill with just the slightest provocation. I spend a considerable amount of time with Harrison. I like his strangeness. After my prison experiences and feeling myself something of a cowardly pariah, I see Harrison as another lost and confused soul, damaged by his war experiences. I can empathize with his rage and anarchy. He's a forceful speaker, and we spend many hours together smoking joints, drinking, taking LSD, and discussing sports, study, and our experiences. I'm a good listener for his prodigious monologues on the elements of revolution and philosophy. He often chastises me, calling my writing attempts juvenile stories. He implores me to get on with the serious work of literature. "Together," Harrison often declares confidently, "we will overcome the chains by which society has bound us. Our lives are meant for greater things than our contemporaries. We're both dreamers. That's what separates us from the others." Harrison's the first man to encourage my writing. I half believe his grandiose schemes. Later I move to Los Angeles, find a clerical job, and begin preparing for a return trip to Europe to write my first novel. One Saturday, about 3 months after I moved to L.A., Harrison shows up at my apartment door. He's hitchhiked 800 miles, bringing with him a small suitcase filled with some clothes and 2 ounces of Colombian pot. He says he heard I moved to L.A. to begin work on some serious writing, and he's now here to start serious work on a project of his own. He's also dropped out of university, is being sued for divorce and custody of his 2 children, and has little money. But all that is nothing compared to the importance of his project. He's decided he's going to make an anti-war movie based on his experiences in Vietnam. It's 1976, America's bicentennial year. Only a couple of good movies have been made about the war and, according to Harrison, badly misrepresent what really happened. His own movie is to be based on the actual suffering the ordinary soldier has undergone and will include a highly symbolic and socialist point of view. Harrison moves into my apartment. During the days, while I'm working as a clerk, Harrison hitchhikes to Hollywood and Westwood, trying to locate and arrange meetings with movie producers, agents, scriptwriters, and artists he thinks will be receptive to his idea. In the evenings, I bring home food and beer. We sit around drinking, smoking Harrison's dope, and discussing the philosophy of Herbert Marcuse, the lyrics of Bob Dylan, and the work of such anti-war writers as Dalton Trumbo, Hermann Hesse, and Kurt Vonnegut. Harrison is a man possessed. Nothing can keep him from succeeding in his righteous cause. He's utterly convinced of the inevitability of what he sees as the divine mission of his life. It has been his fate to undergo the suffering he has in order to become an important voice of his generation. Had it not been the same for Jesus, he reasons, for Rambo, for Apollinaire, for Bob Dylan? Even his current family crisis is part of the plan. It's tearing him apart emotionally to know he'll lose his wife and children, but it's still a necessary sacrifice to make. Harrison's motivational fires are fueled when he's able to contact and interest both the movie director Paul Schrader and Christopher Trumbo, Dalton Trumbo's son and a television scriptwriter. Harrison envisions the artistic and commercial success of his project. No longer will people scoff at his ideas and plans. They'll now have to stand up and take notice that he, Harrison Gant, is not just another demented Vietnam vet who babbles at length about idealistic notions and unattainable dreams. No, they'll be forced to give respect not only to him, but also to all the forsaken ones of his generation, all the silent, suffering artists of a malevolent and insensitive world. All he has to do is prepare a rough draft of his idea, and his friends Christopher Trumbo and Paul Schrader will polish and fine-tune it into the final screen product to which he'll be the technical advisor. In the end, a great message will be given to the people. Harrison and I'll be rich and able to pursue our true artistic destinies instead of having to toil like automatons for the rest of our lives, lost in the vast complexity of the machination of the American system. It'll be a grand future. More practical matters, however, must be dealt with first. Harrison receives a phone call from one of his brothers who is living in L.A. and working as a carpenter. The brother explains that Harrison has been given a summons to appear in court in a week's time. Harrison doesn't have the money to pay for a lawyer and court fees. He persuades me to loan him $700. He says he'll return in 2 weeks to continue work on his project. I wish him good luck and watch him disappear on a hot August day. 3 weeks pass. Harrison doesn't return. Then, one night, I get a phone call from him. He says that 2 nights after returning to Arcata, he went out with a friend drinking and explained about his project, but the friend didn't believe him and began ridiculing him and saying that he ought to quit dreaming and start acting like a man and take better care of his family. They left the bar, and while outside began arguing. Harrison grabbed the friend, who then stabbed him in the side and back with a knife. I later hear that Harrison, who is a much bigger man, was choking the friend, who, afraid he was going to be killed, stabbed Harrison in self-defense. Harrison spent 10 days in the hospital recovering from his wounds. He lost the divorce case and custody of his children. A week later, he shows up at my apartment again. A great transformation has taken place. Gone is the energetic, intelligent man of substance and inspiration. In his place is now a haggard, unshaven wreck of a being. He looks tired and defeated. His eyes emit a continual vacant stare. He hasn't even bothered to contact his lawyer, but has used my money to buy a half pound of marijuana. He says he plans to sell it to recover the money and pay me back. The anti-war film project now becomes the biggest event of the century, bigger than the Woodstock celebration. Harrison will organize it and call it Peace Talks. Every famous musician, artist, and politician of the far left will be involved. Harrison believes himself the revolutionary hero of the times. When I leave the apartment in the mornings to go to my job, Harrison is lying on the couch smoking marijuana, listening to Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks album, and lost in his thoughts. His head's held in his right hand as if the weight of his reveries is too great for any man to endure. When I return in the evenings, he's in the same position, listening to the same album, still smoking marijuana. The ashtray on the table beside the couch is filled with roaches. At night, while I sleep, Harrison walks the streets for hours before returning to the couch. Other than these nocturnal wanderings, he seldom leaves the apartment. One night he returns about 4 in the morning with a street bum he claims is Bob Dylan. Twice he has loud arguments on the phone with his brother, whom he accuses of conspiring against him. He passes 1 week in a state of extreme paranoia, searching every inch of the apartment looking for bugs planted by the CIA. I don't know what to do other than provide a sympathetic ear for his maudlin soliloquies of self-pity and rambling diatribes against the United States. I encourage him to put his sufferings down on paper, to get to work on the rough draft to be given to Paul Schrader and Christopher Trumbo, to give his lamentations a canvas to work out all the bitterness and hatred inside him and turn it into something positive. But he dismisses my encouragement as so much patronizing. He continues smoking the marijuana and listening to the same Dylan album. Then, one afternoon, when I return home from work, Harrison is in the apartment talking animatedly with a woman who lives in one of the other apartments in the building. She's in her 40s, a bit plump, wearing an excess of makeup, and has the look of a woman who was once beautiful but is now ravaged by time, experience, and alcohol. She's a chain smoker and has a deep guttural cough that interrupts every other sentence she speaks. The two are discussing her life. She seems to regard Harrison as a man from whom she can learn much. Each time she explains a particular phase of her life, she leans forward eagerly in anticipation of Harrison's response. I open 3 bottles of beer and sit down to listen to their conversation. The woman says, "You know, just the other day I saw a doctor. They took x-rays of my lungs and found a cancerous tumor on the left lung. I don't know what to do. I just know that God is punishing me. This is the last of a long line of problems in my life."
She stops, coughs violently for a minute, then continues. They want to remove the lung. I just know I'm going to die a painful and horrible death.
Tears roll down her cheeks, and she coughs again. Harrison jumps up from the couch, paces the room a few times, sits down again in the head held in the right-hand position, and begins murmuring incomprehensible sounds. The woman looks incredulously at me for a moment, then back at Harrison. An excruciatingly long time passes. Then Harrison sits up straight, opens his eyes, smiles at the woman, and says, "Go now, my child. You've been healed."
"Who the hell are you, anyway, Jesus Christ?" she says, half laughing.
"Go now, my child. You've been healed," Harrison says. If not for having been with Harrison over the previous few months, I'd think it all a strange joke, but Harrison has an entirely serious expression on his face. There is a certain aura about him at that moment. The woman seems to recognize it, too. She thanks him for his kindness in listening to her problems, thanks me for the beer, and disappears out the door. Harrison puts the Bob Dylan album on the stereo, lights another joint, and returns to his broodings. 2 hours later, the woman returns to the apartment. She bangs on the door, rushes inside, and begins dancing and jumping around as if unable to contain herself. She embraces Harrison passionately, exclaiming, "I can't believe it! I can't believe it! I'm cured! I'm cured!" She lowers herself to her knees and begins kissing Harrison's feet and wrapping her arms around his legs. Harrison remains upright, expressionless, his right hand gently touching the top of her head. "Thank you! Oh, thank you so much!" she cries, tears streaming down her cheeks. "You really are the Christ, aren't you? I knew from the first you were no ordinary man. Oh, thank you! Thank you!" She rises to her feet and gathers her emotions. She breathes deeply a number of times. Her cough is gone. She hasn't coughed once in all her excitement since entering the apartment. Harrison looks at her kindly, not saying a word. "I'm not coughing! I'm not coughing! I'm going to live! How can I ever thank you? I haven't been able to breathe like this for 10 years, and now my lungs are clean! You're truly a savior, a healer, a saint! How can I ever thank you?" She gets down on her knees again and begins weeping. Harrison places his right hand on her shoulder. "You must leave now, please. Don't tell a soul what took place here tonight. I don't believe I can do it again. Please, you must leave."
She rises to her feet and says, "I'll do anything you ask. My dear man, I'll do anything you ask."
She leaves. I stare at the door for a moment, then turn around to look at Harrison. He's back on the couch, head held in his hands. Small tears are running down his cheeks. 2 weeks later, I get 4 days off for Thanksgiving vacation. I pack most of my belongings to take to the San Francisco area, where I'll meet my mother and stepfather at a family friend's home. I plan to store my things at their home in Truckee until I return from my next journey abroad. The apartment is bare except for the bed, the couch, the kitchen table, 2 chairs, and the refrigerator, all of which came with the apartment. I shake Harrison's hand and tell him to take care and that I'll be back in a few days. I'll live in the apartment for 1 more month, quit my job at the end of December, and leave for Europe on January 1st. When I return a few days later, Harrison is gone. There is no note. One of the chairs is broken. The landlady appears at the door.
"I want you out of here within a week," she says.
"What happened?"
"Your friend and his brother had a fight, and there was much shouting. An older woman downstairs nearly had a heart attack. Then the next day your friend wandered over to the school next door, the all-girls Catholic elementary school. He entered the school grounds and started touching some of the girls while they were at recess. He was telling them he was Jesus Christ. The nuns called the police and they took him away."
"Do you know where he is now?" I ask.
"I don't know and I don't care. I want you out of here and I don't want to see any more of your friends. Do you understand me?"
One of my co-workers allows me to stay in his garage until the end of the year. There is a sofa in the garage I can sleep on. 2 days later, I receive a phone call at work from Harrison, who sounds calm and rational over the phone. He's being held at a mental institute about 20 miles away. He asks me to visit him that evening. At the institute, an orderly leads me to a locked door that opens to a wing with a main lobby with tables and chairs. Beyond the lobby is a hallway that has several rooms on both sides. Each room has 2 beds and a nightstand. At the far end of the hallway is a single chair, bolted to the floor, that has leg and arm straps attached to it. Harrison comes out of his room and meets me in the lobby. We're given an hour to visit. We sit down at a table with four chairs around it. Harrison is pale and gaunt, but his eyes are clear and defiant whenever one of the orderlies walks by.
"These fucking orderlies, man," Harrison says. "They were forcing all the inmates to take Thorazine. I refused at first, and when three orderlies grabbed me, I beat the shit out of all three of them. 10 more were called in. They strapped me to the chair at the end of the hall and injected the Thorazine into my ass, if you can believe it."
Harrison shows me his buttocks, which are still black and blue.
"It hurts like hell to sit down, but I'm not going to show the others I feel any pain. They all respect me now. They call me the Rock, you know, like Rocky Marciano."
Harrison introduces me to some of the inmates in the room. They have glassy eyes and giggle nervously.
"So, Harrison, when do you think you'll get out? Will they keep you here long?" I ask. I'm not sure whether I should ask about what happened at the school. It doesn't seem relevant.
"Not to worry, bro." Harrison looks directly at me and smiles. "They're not charging me with any crime. They're just holding me till they think I'm well enough to return to the outside world. My brother's talking to a lawyer, and they're going to get me out of here soon."
"Are you sure? Can they do that?"
"No problem, man. They're working on the maladjusted Vietnam veteran angle. There are plenty of us around. Should be no problem. I've been through worse than this."
Harrison reaches across the table, gives me a soul shake, and says, "Thanks for coming, bro. It means a lot to me." I visit Harrison once a week for the next 3 weeks. During my last week at work, I get another call. He has suddenly been released for no reason and is now in downtown Los Angeles. He has no money. He begged the quarter he just used to make the call. He has no clothes other than what he's wearing. I agree to meet him after work. I drive downtown, take Harrison to a restaurant to eat, and give him an extra sweater and $10. After that, he's on his own. I'm leaving to Europe in a few days. We shake hands. As I start to get in my car, Harrison calls to me.
"Don't worry about the Brock, bro. I'm going to make it just fine."
He walks down the street in the opposite direction, singing a Bob Dylan song from the album he played over and over in my apartment. That's the last time I ever see him.
"War! Good God, y'all! What is it good for? Give it to me one time now. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing."
Harrison faded, replaced by Tommy Edwards dancing in my head a few years later after I'd been around the world and returned to the States and worked here and there before ending up in West Palm Beach, Florida, where I found a room for $45 a week in the Cuban section and came across Tommy, a blonde, powerfully built young man from South Carolina. He had a room in the same run-down motel and was working as a heavy equipment operator at a job site on the outskirts of town. We decided to become roommates and moved into a two-room bungalow after I found a job as a day cook at the Hilton Hotel. There we are in the languid evenings of early autumn, exhausted from our days of labor, swapping life stories while swilling bottles of beer. Tommy tells about his youth, about growing up in a small South Carolina town, about how his mama raised 5 kids after his daddy left home never to be seen again. He remembers months of eating nothing but tomato sandwiches on dry bread. There is a memory of his daddy's liquor still and the bottles hidden in different corners of the shack they live in. One day his daddy beats his mama and Tommy pisses in one of the bottles. Later his daddy drinks from the bottle, pukes, grabs Tommy and beats him until Tommy's ears bleed. Another memory is the time 5 blacks gang up on his older brother and beat him to a pulp. A year later the brother dies. Tommy blames it on them fucking niggers. He says with a bitter smirk, 4 of them are now wearing concrete shoes at the bottom of a lake. The 5th they found in a ditch, his head torn apart by a shotgun blast. There are stories of teenage Friday nights in the boring South Carolina summers when Tommy and some of his buddies ride around in souped-up Chevys and Fords, drinking beer and throwing the bottles at elderly black people. Another story has the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan and their arms cache hidden in the hills, where they undergo guerrilla training and use real blacks for hunting practice. I never know how much of these stories to believe. Tommy's memories of his army days aren't very clear. He says he was chosen for special forces training near the end of the Vietnam War. At the end of the training, he's one of a few who are picked to experience simulated prisoner of war conditions. He's given a drug being tested by the Army for interrogation purposes. About a week later, he's just coming off guard duty, still armed with his M16, when suddenly he's thrust mentally into another world. He's inside the enemy's camp. The barracks building across the road is the Viet Cong's headquarters. He sprays the side of the barracks with three bursts from his M16. Someone clubs him from behind. That's all he remembers. He spends 4 months in a psychiatric ward. The army discharges him after he signs some papers. He doesn't remember what he signed, but it has something to do with returning twice a year for electric shock treatments and receiving $70,000. He quits going to the military hospital after 3 years of treatments. The pain is too much. He knows he's losing his mind. Tommy remembers only bits and pieces of those 3 years. He doesn't know what happened to the $70,000. When he first returns home, he goes into the wooded swamps outside his hometown and lives in seclusion for 6 months with his two dogs. That's all he remembers. He says he now moves every 4 or 5 months because the government is after him. He can't write or telephone his mama. The government has her phone tapped and checks her mail. He says if they ever catch up with him, there'll be hell to pay, and more shock treatments. His speech is already impaired. They'll have to kill him before he lets them drag him back to that hospital. Gary Minch, a friend of Tommy, who also works as a heavy equipment operator at the same job site, moves into the bungalow in December. He's a short, muscular, embittered Vietnam vet who was wounded in the war, returned to his home in New Jersey, married his high school sweetheart, had two daughters, started his own trucking business, found his grip on life gradually slipping away, and now hates the America he's returned to. He began selling drugs, was busted, and lost his business and family while he went to jail for a year. He has drifted from job to job down the eastern seaboard until finally coming to Florida. The three of us share an inability to cope in an America indifferent to the death visions of our subterranean lives. Confessions of our brushes with death fill our nocturnal explorations of one another's soul. The beer we drink and the $5 bags of pot bought in the black ghetto of West Palm Beach when we pile into my $500 rusted-out Ford van, me at the wheel, Tommy on the passenger side to do the bargaining, and Gary in the back with a baseball bat in case there's trouble. We smoke loosens our tongues and strengthens our memories. Gary and I are the voluble ones. Gary speaks with bitter, morbid pride of the times he's killed, the patrols in the jungle he's survived, the smell, taste, and sound of the horrors of war, the fights in prison, the drugs taken, the cold burn of the shrapnel still embedded in his back, the nightmares that haunt his sleep. I counter with my own vital Asian and road tales. In the beginning, our discussions contain elements of competitiveness and animosity. Philosophically, we're poles apart. Gary is given to violence and believes completely in its use to protect oneself, to establish one's moral and physical boundaries and rights, to inflict punishment upon one's enemies. Everything is black and white to him. There are your friends, those who stand beside you. There are your enemies, those who oppose you. Nothing in between. There can be nothing in between. His experiences have taught him that. I still cling to a philosophy of pacifism, or at least a pacifism that recognizes force only as a last resort. I have the advantage of my years of literary pursuit and often assail Gary with the words of some literary giant who expounded on the virtues of love, compassion, peace, patience, and a humble spirit. Gary's helpless against this kind of polemic. Invariably, he returns to the kind of attack he's most confident in. He'll challenge me to a physical contest. One night it's a 100-yard dash, another a wrestling match, another an arm wrestling contest, another a push-up competition. These contests are hard-fought, as if our lives and beliefs are on the line. Neither of us dominates the other. Over the next few weeks, the distance and competitiveness between us disappears. Gary has always thought of pacifists and conscientious objectors as wimps and faggots through and through. He has never met anyone who expresses a distaste for violence, yet doesn't back down from a challenge. He asks me for books to read. He begins to listen more intently to my words, to show the softer side of his nature. The manner in which he talks about his experiences in Vietnam and prison changes from boastfulness to confession. Sometimes Gary pores over my manuscripts, finds a paragraph that strikes a vein of truth in his heart, and exclaims, "That's it! That's just the way I think about things! It's great you can use language like that! If only I could speak this way! If only I could use words instead of my fists to get my point across!" The relationship turns strange. Gary begins to relate to me as if I'm some kind of pseudo-teacher, a pseudo-guru, as if he has been searching for a personal Christ and has stumbled upon me. Overwhelmed by such unwarranted veneration, I become drunk with the sound of my own eloquence in comparison to this poor fellow's ignorance of the world of books. I take to my Christ role eagerly, as if knowing I've shirked facing death in Vietnam and then exorcised my guilt by purposely plunging headfirst into the death world of Turkey, of Iran, of Afghanistan, and above all of India, in order to taste it, smell it, touch it, know it as the thousands of child soldiers like Gary did in Nam. And now, having survived all that, I'm in the process of being reinstated in the eyes of my persecutors. Yes, the balance of the relationship between Gary and me has shifted heavily in my favor. I lord it over Gary with a sense of self-righteous superiority. I'm a sick motherfucker myself. Gary and I begin to ignore Tommy, who often sits at a distance during our discussions, brooding and giving off a look of incomprehensibility, as if he's listening to a foreign language. Sometimes he turns on the TV and stares vacantly at it, waiting for commercial breaks when he can mock the announcers and the products they're selling. One night he turns away from the TV, stares intently at Gary, and says, "You're not as tough as you think you are." They begin wrestling on the sofa. Suddenly Tommy's eyes roll back. He falls to the floor, muscles cramping, mouth frothing, face quivering and screaming, "No more! Please, no more!" I jump out of my chair, shout to Gary, "He's having a flashback!" and vigorously massage Tommy's back and neck. Gary slaps Tommy's face, presses Tommy's body against his own, and shouts, "You're with us, Tommy! You're with us! You're okay! We love you, man! It's not real! You're with us!" Tommy finally relaxes. He's breathing hard. His face is pale. Tears are in his eyes. 3 days later, when I return from work, Tommy is gone. Winter passes. Neither Gary nor I are making much money. We're fed up with our jobs and with Florida. We decide to head back toward Texas and try to find jobs on the oil rigs. In April, we load our belongings into my van and head across the Everglades, up the Florida Panhandle, pass through Alabama into Mississippi, then on to Louisiana. All along the Gulf Coast, we look for jobs, but Gary can't pass the physical exams because of the shrapnel in his back. Our money is nearly gone, only $50 left between us. We pitch camp outside of Houma, Louisiana. We smoke a couple of joints, and Gary wants to explore the forest. We enter the forest, and it's as if Gary is transported back to the time he was a point man on patrols in Vietnam. We paint our faces with mud and get down on our bellies and crawl through the thick black brush. Gary seems more alive than at any time since we've met. The game goes on for an intolerably long time. We come upon a snake. Gary kills it with his hands. He begins making animal sounds and shouting hysterically, "We killed the Kong! We killed the Kong!" 2 days later, we're in Galveston, Texas. After checking several job possibilities, we find Gary a job as a galahad aboard a tug that will be out to sea for 2 months at a time, servicing oil barges along the Gulf Coast. I give Gary an old backpack to stuff a few sets of clothes in. We part with a handshake. I then hook on with a catering company and spend the next few months working as a steward on the oil rigs.
"War! It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker! War! Friend only to the undertaker!"
I opened my eyes, sucked in a deep breath, and swallowed to try to get rid of the lump in my throat. One of the other stoners drew a hit off the hookah. I watched the trail of blue smoke rise as he exhaled slowly and leaned back into the sofa. The Chambers brothers' voices wafted over me.
"Time has come today!"
The brain was off and running with a new stream.
"The rules have changed today. I have no place to stay. Oh, my Lord, I have to roam. I have no home. I have no home."
That's exactly how I felt then when I knew Harrison and Tommy and Gary, and God knows that's how they and all the lost children of my generation felt, that Vietnam War generation, all the many Davids and the many character actors who filled his life. And what about the 200,000 vets who somehow survived the war and returned to a country that couldn't have cared less, and they ended up offing themselves? 4 times the number who died in the war, and yeah, all those who ended up in prison or homeless.
What are those statistics now? Those stats that say something like, by 1980, around a third of America's prisoners were Vietnam vets, and more recently, more than a third of America's homeless were vets, and...
Now the time has come. There is no place to run. I've been loved and put aside. I've been crushed by the tumbling tide. My soul's been psychedelicized.
And that's no shit, bro. My soul has been forever psychedelicized, and there's no return for the psychedelicized.
Now the time has come. There are things to realize.
Which are what? What have I realized in all these years of living? That all is as it was meant to be? That's good enough for me. This is what I've come to see. That all men are not meant to be free. Every generation returns to the sea. Whatever. Maybe Thomas Cunard will have something to say about all this.
Time has come today.
Grand Funk Railroad now blared through the speakers. The madness of my thoughts disappeared, and Mark Farner's guitar on Inside Looking Out carried me to distant places in my mystic altered state. The sound of the sea and closer to home soothed me, and I floated on a serene, secure feeling while waves of colors filled my head.
I'm getting closer to my home.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
I'm getting closer to my home.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
I'm getting closer to my home.
When the song finished, I opened my eyes slowly. The other stoners were gone. I got up, reacquainted myself with the outer world, stretched and worked out a few mushroom kinks, put one foot in front of the other, descended the stairs, and headed back into the crowded Amsterdam streets. I returned to the room, took off my shoes, and stretched out on the bed. I took the chess game with all the extra pieces I had accumulated over the last few hours out of my pocket and played a few more variations of my life. When I finished playing, I put the game away and lay back on the bed. I still had a stony feeling, but the intensity was fading. I looked out the window and watched the tree in front of the Oude Kerk sway in the breeze. Then, as if to provide a musical climax to the entire journey, the church bells rang out a concert of classical songs, each meant, I smiled and thought, to ease the final transition and fix in my mind that this had indeed been a worthwhile journey. I closed my eyes and the bells took me into a void, each note vibrating delightfully in my mind, and I floated gently with the stream, lost in less difficult and detailed thoughts than before. The last note lingered, then lapsed into silence. I opened my eyes and looked around the room. I felt as if I had completed a long meditation session. I went into the bathroom and turned on the water. I did a few more stretches, then climbed into the tub. There was still a light yellow glow to everything, including the water in the tub, but as my muscles relaxed, the glow lessened. When I emerged from the tub, I felt thoroughly cleansed inside and out. I looked at the radio clock on the dresser. It was 4:30 in the afternoon. The trip had lasted about 6 hours.